Session number 3178, reel number 3.
So Jeffrey Tuttle, reel 3. How did you come to be placed under arrest?
Actually, I was not quite under arrest when I saw him. I had just completed my second solo flight, and being convinced that I was the best pilot in the world, I beat up a train going past the local railway station. Unfortunately, the wing commander's wife was on board. She took the number of the aircraft and apparently over lunch said to her husband, "Oh, I saw one of your aircraft today, and its number was so-and-so." And that resulted in my being sent for and very, very nearly brought my RAF career, which was then 6 weeks old, to a grinding halt, because I was still on probation and he had the authority to get rid of me there and then. He decided to give me one more chance, so he is a much better chap than I indicated earlier on in what I just said.
If one was court-martialed for low-flying and found guilty, were you automatically discharged?
You were not automatically discharged. There was a time when the amount of low-flying was causing a lot of complaints and quite a number of accidents. And then, as a disciplinary matter, it became clear that if you were found guilty of low-flying, you would leave the service.
Did this happen to anyone in 19 Squadron while you were at Duxbury?
Not as far as I know.
In 1928, after 3 years at Duxford, you were sent to the Central Flying School for a three-month course to learn to become a flying instructor. Were you there, in fact, learning the same system of instruction as you yourself had been taught by when you first joined up at Duxford?
Yes, it was exactly the same system, obviously modernised week by week in the light of experience, modified depending on the pupil and his adequacy.
Did you find it quite interesting to learn this system, the Central Flying School system, having been on the other end of it, as it were?
Yes, I think being a flying instructor is one of the most interesting things you can be, and therefore learning how to be one was very, very interesting.
Was it difficult to grasp how to do the instruction, or was it simply a matter of learning a basic technique?
I think there's far more to it than just learning a technique. Part of it, of course, was two of you pupils at the Central Flying School would go up together and give each other lessons and criticise each other. The main lesson, I think, in flying instruction is having the confidence to let your pupil go as far as you can without actually destroying anything, because he learns far quicker than you losing your nerve and taking over.
After the flying experience that you'd had yourself, did you find that you'd got into any bad habits in the way of flying when you came to learn the proper way of instructing other people at the Central Flying School?
As far as I know, no, because you see, the whole of your time in the squadron, you were checked every now and again by your flight commander to see if you were developing any bad habits.
One of the elements at the Central Flying School at that time was learning about instrument flying. Mm. Was this an innovation for you yourself?
We had the only instrument flying we had done, and we had to do it, was on the compass and the bubble to show your lateral position. Their improved instruments, gyro controlled, were coming along. And they were installed in the first place in a bomber, and I can't remember what sort of bomber, at the Central Flying School, and we were taught the elements of instrument flying, and were taught in this aircraft, in a blacked out cockpit, facing with the pilot yourself, facing backwards with the instructor, facing forwards and able to see out. This was to remove what was then called the seat of the pants feeling, so that you had no, your senses had no relation to what the aircraft or the instruments were doing. And I think in that way was a very good thing to do. And we were able to take off and land totally blind, facing the wrong way. But again, it's important to remember the takeoff run was very short and the runway was omnidirectional.
Was it a difficult thing to grasp, nevertheless?
It was difficult to break the habit of wanting to do what you felt you wanted to do, whereas the only thing to do was to believe the instruments, which of course now is perfectly normal to everybody.
Were these the same instruments that you'd had on the Grebe and the Siskel?
Oh no, they were advanced instruments. Some of them were gyro-controlled, particularly the direction. A compass doesn't react quick enough for a blind takeoff.
Another thing that you had to do there was learning inverted formation flying. Mm. Had you done any of that before?
Inverted formation flying wasn't on the syllabus for training to be a flying instructor, but the flying instructors at the Central Flying School were famous for their inverted formation flying. We did not do it ourselves, although we spent quite a lot of time flying upside down and had some aircraft fitted with engines that would run upside down for a short period. The lubrication, of course, would normally let them down in the end.
Was there any practical purpose to the inverted flying?
The practical purpose is being complete master of the aircraft in any situation.
Was it in fact difficult to master the skill of doing that?
I don't know. I don't think it's terribly difficult to do at all once you concentrate on doing it and realize. I mean, the first thing is, once you are upside down, it's quite clear everything is different. So that in itself imposes a discipline.
Your flight commander there was Basil Embry. And
one of the flight commanders. My flight commander, that's right, yes.
And you found he had rather an unusual way of getting used to the upside-down sensation.
I went to call on his wife and him one Wednesday afternoon with a friend of mine, and he was hung up on the dining room ceiling in a chair with harness on, spending the afternoon there, getting used to being upside down. She didn't even let him down for tea.
Did he manage to drink his tea upside down?
No, he didn't have anything.
When you completed the course at the Central Flying School, were you in fact tested yourself at the end of it in your competence?
You were tested by the chief flying instructor at the Central Flying School, all of us were, and given a category, depending on how well you'd done. Some people, of course, failed and never became flying instructors. In the same way, when I became a flying instructor, I have found, as other people have, there are some people who never learned.
Was the ability to be an instructor depended on more than just your own ability to handle the aeroplane?
It must also depend on your ability to put it over as an instructor to a pupil, to know all about the aircraft and to be able to fly properly yourself. But it isn't only flying.
When you passed out of the Central Flying School then, you were then sent in at the end of 1928 to number 605 Squadron, County of Warwick Squadron. What kind of squadron was that?
That was an auxiliary squadron. All the aircraft with numbers in the 600s were auxiliary squadrons, and the auxiliary Air Force had recently, and I think it was in 1926, been invented as another way of producing pilots and other ranks available for war. They were weekend flyers. The squadron consisted of three regular officers, the flight lieutenant, the flying instructor, in this case myself, a flying officer, and an equipment officer.
This was a very small group of regular officers. How did you get on together?
The flight lieutenant was a very old man, again. He lived out with his wife. And I think I ought to explain that an auxiliary squadron, the auxiliary pilots and the mechanics, the other ranks, all came in at the weekend if they wanted to. We spent the weekday getting the aircraft ready, in my case teaching them to fly if any of the auxiliaries wanted to turn up and have a flying lesson, but otherwise we were alone. And in my case, there were just two of us living in the officer's mess for most of the week. It so happened in this case, this was a chap who was quite different in his way of life from myself. I wouldn't dream of suggesting who was right and who was wrong. It was quite clear we were not going to get on together. So I got hold of him and said, let us use the mess separately during the week and jointly when all the auxiliaries are there. The result was we never had lunch or supper together, and the thing worked beautifully, but it was a problem that needed facing.
What kind of people were the people who came in as it was auxiliary officers?
The auxiliary officers tended to be the young people, young men who wanted to fly proper aircraft, not just club aircraft, and they tended to be the sons of rich families. They all had Lagondas and Bentleys and things like that. And they were an incredibly good lot of people. And unfortunately, when the war came, most of them lost their lives.
How often were they able to get along? Did they come most of them come every weekend to?
Most of them came every weekend. Some you very rarely saw. We had one tremendous chap who had a Victoria Cross. He was, of course, the hero. He got it in the army, but he was terribly old, too. But he actually flew with us and was the local hero. He didn't stay with us long because he got a bit too old for flying. But they came while they were learning to fly. They would probably come and live in the mess for a fortnight and then come as often as they could. A lot of them didn't really have full-time jobs, and they had benevolent fathers and did quite a lot of flying.
Did you find that you yourself were kept busy enough in this particular job?
Oh, there was plenty to do because all the aircraft had to be kept fit, tested, and I got a lot of flying in testing them and looking after. See, there were only two of us to look after the regular men who kept the aircraft serviceable in the week and who instructed the auxiliaries auxiliary mechanics when they turned up at the weekend.
There were also auxiliary airmen.
Auxiliary airmen as well, oh yes. And so a squadron, then once a year we went away to the practice camp where we did our, this was a bomber squadron, so we did our bombing with real bombs, and the entire squadron went, and the squadron commander was an auxiliary himself. It would go under his command and be run by him like a regular squadron for 2 weeks at practice camp with the regular officers assisting.
Did you find that at the practice camp the auxiliary people were of a high standard?
In general, they were as good as regulars, undoubtedly.
Tell me the story of how you managed to get out of difficulties after a mishap with a particularly difficult aeroplane that you had.
Well, in this auxiliary squadron, as I have said, we had these only three regulars, and I was the flying instructor. One day I was going through the hangar to fly one of the aircraft to test it after an inspection, and in the hangar we had what is known as a rogue aircraft, which was never serviceable, and it always appeared to be in trouble. And the flight sergeant, I said to the flight sergeant, how is that aircraft today? And he said, oh sir, it's unserviceable again. What shall we do? And I said, oh, burn the bloody thing. And that was that. He, of course, was a flight sergeant and much older than I was, but he'd asked my opinion, and I gave it. 40 minutes later, I flew back to Castle Bromwich Airfield, and there was a column of smoke. To my horror, he had actually burnt the bloody thing, obeying an order given by an officer, and therefore I was in the wrong. I didn't know what to do, and I thought, well, now the only thing to do when you're in a mess like this is to get hold of headquarters. I'd always been told headquarters was there to help, so I rang up the headquarters, and the wing commander I got hold of, a chap I'd never met, and of course who was terribly senior, I said to him, look, you're there to help, and I want some help, and explained what I'd done, and please could he help me. He said, well, it had never happened to him before, and he would have to think about it. Eventually, he arranged that a form should be filled up by myself recommending this aircraft, because of its continual unserviceability, should be put in the category of reduced to produce, which it already was, of course. And I filled up the form, sent it off to him. He approved it. But he did say, when he said, this is what we'll do, he said, get rid of it. And so I got hold of the flight sergeant and said, fall in all your men and dig a great hole and bury all of it, which is what happened. And that was the end of the story. I think the important lesson is there: when in doubt, tell the truth. And secondly, when always be careful to mean what you say and say what you mean. Because it was nearly the end of my career again.
Did you find that you were left fairly free to pursue your own duties there, fairly free from outside supervision again from headquarters?
Oh, completely. I mean, you didn't need supervision. There was a clear thing to be done. There was a training scheme. There were enthusiastic people to fly, enthusiastic airmen to teach. And we, our squadron, kept on winning the trophy for the best auxiliary squadron. Well, that's the only incentive you need. You don't need checking.
What was the trophy actually given for?
The best squadron. I can't remember now at all what the trophy was called, but we kept on winning it.
What were the different elements, I mean, in the assessment?
Well, I mean, amount of flying, bombing accuracy, gun firing accuracy, attendances by the auxiliaries. It was a trophy for the auxiliaries, not for the regulars. It was the general assessment of squadron efficiency.
Did you actually have anything to do with the actual bombing side of the squadron's work, or were you...
Only showing how to do it from a pilot's point of view.
How do you mean?
To do a bombing run, how to teach the bomb aimer to tell you what to do through the intercom, and when to release the bomb and so on.
In 1930, or thereabouts, you had to take steps to continue your RAF career because your short service commission was shortly to expire. What steps did you have to take to secure a permanent commission?
There were two ways of getting a permanent commission, neither of which were very easy. A very, very, very small number of short service officers were given a short service commission on merit, like two a year. Then a few more were given if you specialised in a particular subject and passed the exam. You could specialise in armament, photography, engineering, signals, and so on. I chose to specialise in engineering because I had been nearly 2 years as an engineering apprentice. So in 1930, I went to Henlow, to the engineering college there, to do a two-year course. On the same course, we had Cranwellians, who also had to specialise in something, and other people like myself with short service commissions. By 1932, I had succeeded in passing.
Was there any general examination for switching from permanent commission, from short service commission to a permanent commission, apart from...
No, your annual reports and your annual continuous reports would give the board that decides whether to give you a permanent commission or not would suffice. I think it's worth remembering then that an annual report on an officer gave everything he was... gave a complete report whether he was exceptionally good or exceptionally bad.
What did the actual course at Henlow actually consist of in the engineering line?
I think the best way of saying it's a sort of potted apprenticeship. There was practical work in all the workshops, whether it was machining, welding, carpentry, and so on, and lessons in mathematics, calculus, metallurgy, physics, chemistry, and so on. It was like a potted apprenticeship, really.
Had you, in fact, already covered some of the ground in your earlier apprenticeship?
Some of it. That's why I chose engineering as opposed to one of the others. Not that I wanted to be an engineer.
Did you have any opportunity of keeping in flying practice while you were at Henley?
Luckily, I was very popular in the auxiliary squadron I had been at, and most weekends I was welcomed back there to help with the instructing, and I would fly up to Castle Bromwich and spend the weekend there flying and helping them out instructing. Also, three of us on the course formed our own formation of three Moth aircraft, and we went around the country doing formation aerobatics, which is unusual for embryo engineers. It may be worth mentioning that of those three, one became Chief of the Air Staff, one was killed in the Battle of Britain, and the other's me.
What were the names of the other two?
Pike and Barwell.
Whereabouts did you go to do this?
We were invited to go to all sorts of places, including Hendon and other places around the country. We loved it. Of course, didn't get paid for it and didn't want to.
Were these not RAF places that you
not necessarily. Oh, not necessarily RAF places. I remember, for example, doing one at Cambridge, where I brought my family to see their remarkable child fly.
Was there one particular one that was rather unfortunate when your family were actually watching?
Well, at Cambridge, the first time my family had ever seen any much flying, I invited them to come and see this performance. And before the three of us did our aerobatics, an aeroplane doing a solo aerobatic turn dived into the ground, having pulled all its wings off. This did not encourage my family ever to want to fly.
Had they, in fact, become reconciled to your career in the RAF by then?
Oh, they were entirely reconciled to it, because they realised it was what I wanted to do and what I was going to do, and there was no, shall I say, family opposition at all.
Do you think any stigma still attached to it amongst your family's friends?
I think it's an extraordinary thing that the Royal Air Force didn't lose this stigma until World War II. It had to go through a war to get it, to make people realise it was needed.
When you passed the course at Hendo in 1932, you were then posted to Karachi in India. Was that your own choice to go to India?
I volunteered to go to India because it was the only place there was a war going on, and I thought that would be more interesting than anywhere else. It was quite exceptional to volunteer to go to India, and therefore I was accepted immediately. I had to do my time as an engineer officer, and the first 3 years were spent in the aircraft depot at Drigg Road, where I was in the aircraft repair section, but I spent most of my time flight testing and delivering to the frontier the aircraft that we overhauled, repaired, and made serviceable again. There was one interesting sideline while we were there. We assembled, built, and tested the aircraft in which the then Marquess of Clydesdale flew over Everest. That was an extremely interesting thing to do, as they were very unusual aircraft.
What sort of aircraft were they?
One was a special air. They were both made by Westlands. One had a specially extended wing to get it as high as possible, and one was a modified Wallis, which was a development of the well-known Wapiti. After 3 years in Karachi, where I enjoyed myself because the social life, the sea and the sailing and the swimming were tremendously good, and I got a lot of flying in, I came home on leave for 2 months. My mother paid my fare. I think the interesting point there is it took 5 days to fly home, and what are now immense international airports were huts. Bahrain was a wooden hut. Kuwait was only a walled city with a tent. And we took 5 days, including a journey by flying boat from Alexandria through Crete to Brindisi, and then by train to Paris, because Mussolini would not allow the British to fly over Italy. We never got to 100 miles an hour in our airliner, and of course we never flew at night and spent the nights in a hotel. 5 days was a long while, but the sea journey was 3 weeks.
What was the cost of the flight?
The cost was £104 sterling then, which compares not unfavorably with today's fare, but it wasn't cheap.
When you were at Karachi, did you find that the course at Henlo that you've been on for 2 years had covered all the ground that you needed to know for your work there, or did you have to improvise a lot?
A lot of the course, like most courses, was completely unnecessary because we were doing the practical job of tearing airplanes to pieces, overhauling them and putting them together again, and the mathematics, the calculus, the use of machine tools never came my way, but I presume it was of some value to know about them.
Did you find that there was any shortage of spare parts or equipment that you needed for repairing the planes?
Of course, at that age, I didn't know much about accounting systems, but I think there are two points. First of all, the entire Air Force, and indeed the Army, was paid for by the Indian government, and they ordered the spares and the aircraft, and incidentally, they paid me. Now and again, they ran out of money, and we were short of certain things because they had run out of money, but the control of spares was not all that it might have been, because in the end, with my friends, we built an extra aircraft out of spare parts, which of course got me a lot of flying. How in the end that was accounted for, I don't know, because I left.